You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You may have heard that there was an election yesterday. In case you're unaware of that, we have invited Anna Marie Cox, Time Magazine Swampland blog contributor and former Wonkette, to fill you in and to assess the fallout across the country. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
You're in Arizona right now. Is it just a coincidence that you're in the same state that John McCain is in?
A total coincidence. I was looking for a place to spend election night, and I thought maybe the Arizona Biltmore would be fun, but it turned out there's a huge crowd here for John McCain.
And the concession
speech. So I ran into them last night.
You decided to be there rather than in Chicago?
Yes, I did. I had a feeling that my colleagues in the media would probably be covering that one pretty well. And I was really interested. I've been covering McCain for about almost 2 years now, since he first started his candidacy. And it's one. I think it's an amazing story. And I wanted to see how it would turn out, and wanted to see how he'd handle it. And I have to say, I thought his speech last night was pretty amazing. And I think in the end, it turned out to be a race between two truly, you know, amazing gentlemen.
Well, it was quite a gracious speech. You traveled, as you said, with McCain during the primaries. How did his campaign change in the time between the primaries and the general election?
Well, we saw towards the end, I think, you know, there's been a lot of commentary that there was a period and that he took, let's say, he used all the ammunition available to him, except for perhaps Jeremiah Wright, to try and define Obama in the eyes of the public. And I don't think that the campaign feels bad about that. I don't think that they have any, they feel like they need to apologize for that. But there was definitely a point when they felt like that there was no case being made against Barack Obama, and they had to make that case using whatever, you know, tools they could. But I think in the end, especially the last few days, I think I at least felt like I saw the John McCain that I started covering 2 years ago. He talked a lot about the economy. He talked a lot about the country. And in the end, you know, he talked about history. And I think there was an enormous sort of sense of momentous happenings last night on his part.
Do you think the addition of former Bush aide Steve Schmidt altered the way that McCain dealt with the press? Some people have said that has been a major problem for him, and then he started complaining that the press was no longer on his side.
Well, you know, I think it's important to realize, number one, that Steve Schmidt served actually for a very short time in the Bush White House. He's not really a Bush person. He's definitely a Steve Schmidt person. And I also think that the press turned on McCain before Schmidt turned on the press. That once McCain got the nomination, there was a sense that we have to shake this guy. You know, we can't be easy on this guy anymore. Not that they were ever really easy on him. But, you know, when you become a nominee, when you become the front runner, you get a lot more scrutiny. And the kind of campaigning that he had done in the past just wasn't going to serve him as a nominee. And I think it's Schmidt that recognized that and actually just sort of really towed the line and forced the candidate to recognize that this is how it was going to have to be if he wanted to be the nominee of his party.
Many people have called last night a blowout for the Democrats. Do you think that we've seen a major shift in the electoral map, similar to what happened after Richard Nixon devised his Southern strategy in 1968?
I think that it's actually the Electoral College. Obviously, was a blowout. I'm looking at the numbers right now, and it's still sort of hard to believe that we had a 349-163 election. But in each individual state, the numbers were a lot closer, and the national numbers was a difference of what I think 6 points. So I think that what we've seen is a tremendous change to the country, obviously historical change. But Barack Obama does not have a mandate to govern as a liberal Democrat. He has a mandate to govern from the center, which is how he won. All of those states that turned blue did not turn blue to elect a liberal Democrat. They turned blue to elect the Barack Obama that was presented to the country over the last few months. And that's a fairly pragmatic candidate.
Well, he also was a clever one because he did run an Electoral College strategy campaign.
Definitely. I think this is one of the smartest campaigns we've ever seen. I think this is going to get written up. This campaign will be written up not just in the history books, but probably in the business books as a textbook for how to run a business. Because this is a campaign that definitely, you know, sort of picked out what the strategy to get not the popular vote at all. I don't think they ever really thought about the popular vote. They thought about the Electoral College, and they ran this campaign with such discipline and such forward-looking, you know, vision that I think that there are going to be companies that want to learn from this, not just other politicians.
Anna Marie later will be joined by some of the journalists who appeared on our show as part of our State of the Union series to discuss the results in their states, some of them rather surprising. And a number of them were considered Republican strongholds, like Indiana and Virginia. They went to President-elect Obama. Georgia, North Carolina, Missouri still remain too close to call. All of them southern or border states with long histories of voting for Republican presidential candidates. What do you think contributed to Obama's appeal in those areas?
I think that the obvious answers are the right ones in this case. I think that George Bush is one of the most unpopular presidents in modern history, and that people are very unhappy about a lot of different things. The economy, probably number one, but also just a sense of stagnation, a sense of problems not being addressed. And in the end, McCain could not make the case that he was the person to address those problems. And I think while there are the polls still show that people are uncertain about Obama's qualifications, uncertain about his experience, the one thing that they are not uncertain about is that he will change the way this country is run, and that he will address these problems that haven't been addressed or that haven't been addressed in a way that is pleasing the American people. And I think that there's no other set of circumstances that could have produced this result. But here it is. We're looking at it.
Well, as he said in his speech last night, President-elect Obama faces two wars, a massive financial crisis, an energy crisis, and much more. The big question in my mind is, what is he going to tackle first?
I think he's going to have to at least, let it be known that he's going to tackle the economy in some significant way first. The wars, thanks in part to John McCain, are actually manageable at this point. And they are not the number one thing that is on the minds of the American public. We have reached a place in the war on terror where we have a little bit of breathing room, where we can take a step back and reassess where we are. And I think Obama has a lot of people he's going to be turning to and talking to about that. And then when it comes to the economy, that's going to be his number one challenge, and that's going to be the thing that people want to know he has a plan about.
It was interesting to note that 136.6 million Americans voted yesterday. That turnout may be the highest percentage of voters since 1908. So people took this election very seriously, and it also helped the Democrats in other ways. They picked up 5 seats in the Senate, 18 in the House. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Congress will be on board for his agenda, does it?
Oh, I think Congress is going to be on board for a lot of it, simply because he is a symbol of such a tremendous change in American politics. But I think that we're going to see, in let's say a year, I think we're going to see Obama really start to struggle with people in his own party over some of the things that he wants to get done. I think right now the people that are coming in feel like they need to make a difference to that amazing, number of voters that turned out for them. But because Obama cannot govern just as a down-the-line Democrat, and yet so many people who ran in Congress probably are down-the-line liberal Democrats, he's going to have to be making deals, and not just with the other party. He's going to have to make deals within his own party.
Well, 2 years ago, the one party controlled the executive and legislative branches of government, and they really went along with President Bush's agenda. Do you think that—
That's true.
But you're saying that the Democrats may not have, because of the nature of the party, or because the country has changed, or are they concerned about making the same types of mistakes the Republicans did when they were in that position and made the whole thing so partisan?
Well, thank you. Actually, you've made all the points that I would like to make. I think it's all of the above. But I do think there's—
Oh, I'm sorry about that. You are the expert, Anna Marie. I'm just the guy who asked the questions.
But no, you've laid it out perfectly. I would say that it's the nature of the party, number one. Although, when I say that the Obama campaign has been so incredibly disciplined and such a future textbook example of how to run a campaign, I also think that they're going to tackle the issue of Congress in the same way. I think the talk of bringing in Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, one of the many reasons why that makes sense, not just because he would be a terribly entertaining person to have back in the White House, is that he is a legislative genius. He, of course, is one who orchestrated the Democratic takeover of the Congress in 06, and he understands the Congress so well. And that is going to be the challenge for Barack Obama, is to not make the same mistakes that other Democrats have made and have that kind of poisonous relationship between the executive branch and legislative branch, and instead turn back to what I would say was a sort of LBJ model, where he really ran the legislative branch from the White House.
My guest is Anna Marie Cox, who's the Time Magazine Swampland blog contributor. It is interesting you mentioned LBJ because, in a way, we've kind of leapfrogged in politics. LBJ changing the whole way that the parties were aligned because of his support of the Civil Rights Act. And now here we are 40 years later, exactly, and we have the first African-American president.
That's right. Couldn't have happened without LBJ, obviously.
But it took 40 years. It's been a 40-year slow transition.
Do you think that LBJ would have thought that 40 years was a long time? I think LBJ probably right now would be surprised at how quickly it's happened.
You mentioned that.
You think about,
probably. I don't know. I think that he made a major transition. After all, he was a guy who had come in as a supporter of many of the Southern strategies of those days. And he convinced an awful lot of Southern senators, Southern legislators, to actually go along with the Civil Rights Act, despite the fact that they had been elected on segregation platforms.
And he convinced them, and despite of what they believed to be their own electoral self-interest, he convinced them to do the right thing. I don't think he ever thought it was going to be the popular thing, or he didn't think it would be the popular thing for some time. But in any case, here we are. Here we are, waking up in the morning and seeing the fruits of that victory. I have to tell you, I'm sure I'm not the only person in the world that woke up thinking that I had just had a strange dream. I had to make sure that I was still living in the same reality that I went to bed in last night.
White support was considered key to John McCain's strategy in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio, states that had gone to Hillary Clinton. What did the exit polling show? Did the whites wind up supporting Senator John McCain?
They supported him enough that a lot of those races were close. We're talking about his electoral blowout, but Pennsylvania, I have to say, the Sarah Palin strategy did not work in Pennsylvania. Obviously, those rural counties turned out, but the sheer mass of suburban white voters, I think, put it over the top for Obama.
You mentioned earlier that the faltering economy was what probably sunk John McCain's candidacy as much as anything, but almost two-thirds of the voters told exit pollers that they didn't think Sarah Palin was qualified to be president. And a lot of conservatives who might have supported John McCain otherwise, maybe holding their nose as they voted, they couldn't go along with Sarah Palin. Do you think that that was as big a mistake as it appears to be? And do you think we've seen the end of Governor Palin?
I think that it turned out to be a mistake. I think that it's also probably true that there is a way that the Sarah Palin pick could have worked. I think that the way it was handled was a mistake as much as the actual pick itself. And in one way to say that it was a mistake also is that a different candidate, someone like, say, Tim Pawlenty, would not have to have been handled. when you pick a vice presidential candidate that needs the kind of babysitting that Sarah Palin needed, well, that's in a campaign that already has such scarce resources, that's a big mistake. The time and energy that went into sort of putting Sarah Palin up to speed and never actually quite getting there.
And I understand that Tina Fey does a bad Pawlenty.
That's true.
But do you think that
great Pawlenty?
Do you think that her Saturday Night Live parody of Governor Palin shaped the public image of her in a way that was irreversible?
I think that Sarah Palin's parody of herself shaped the public opinion of her in a way that was irreversible. In a way, Tina Fey didn't. She herself has said there was not a lot of training or like sharp comedic analysis that went into parodying Sarah Palin. She presented herself as such an easy target. And as so laughable from the beginning, I think Tina Fey is amazing. I'm so looking forward to the new season of 30 Rock. But I don't think Sarah Palin's, or I don't think Tina Fey sunk Sarah Palin. I think Sarah Palin sunk Sarah Palin.
I'm talking with Anna Marie Cox of Time Magazine's blog. She contributes to the Swampland blog. And we're talking about, we're looking back at the election cycle. We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more from Anna Marie and some other people. Stay with us. We're back with Anna Marie Cox, the Time Magazine Swampland blog contributor. And joining us now from Missouri, which is still too close to call, is Joe Manis, regional political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, what was the atmosphere like as voters went to the polls?
Well, I think people were excited, which people always are during an election, but this time I noticed that there was a heightened level of excitement, arguably on both sides, in urban and rural and suburban Missouri. But people really wanted to come out and make their choices. I think, like the nation, people are concerned about the economy. Our exit polls showed that the economy was the driving issue. There was just a whole lot of stuff feeding into it. We had a lot of major statewide races, including a contest for governor, where it was a blowout for the Democrat, Attorney General Jay Nixon.
But he wasn't able to do a reverse coattails?
No, part of it is because Missouri does not have, no longer has, where you can punch or pick one box and automatically is a vote for every candidate of that one party all the way up and down the ballot. And that arguably could have affected Obama a little bit. It definitely affected some of our down-ballot Democratic races in the region. It definitely did that.
Well, the straight ticket voting was just eliminated only recently.
Yes, just for the 2006 election. It was something that the Republican-led legislature did because they thought it might help their candidates if Claire McCaskill had a wave. This was 2 years ago. But this was the first presidential election where it was not allowed, and so a lot of people who maybe hadn't voted in 06, this was the first time they confronted that, and it did contribute to longer lines, especially in some of the urban areas where people are used to that. And, we had long lines, which is something that Missouri never has.
Was the split typically urban-suburban?
Yeah, well, the split actually was urban-rural. The suburbs, actually, the near suburbs, went strongly for Obama. In fact, St. Louis County, which is the largest voting bloc in the state, one of the reasons we've been too close to call is because St. Louis County was late getting their totals in, and it ended up being close to 60% of the vote in St. Louis County went for Obama, which is unbelievably high. Now, St. Louis County does not include the city of St. Louis, which obviously went 83% for Obama. But St. Louis County, which rings the city, arguably is the one that often determines who wins the state. So in some ways, that's one of the reasons we're close statewide, because although Obama and Biden campaigned a lot in rural Missouri, actually the totals they got from the rural counties, for the most part, was in line with the past, where the Democrat didn't do very well. And there were some counties where Obama only got 30% of the vote, or in the mid-30s, these are rural counties. And that's a trend that started about 10 years ago. And Kerry didn't do that well in those counties, and Obama didn't do that well either.
Joe, thank you so much for talking with us. Joe Manis, regional political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Anne-Marie, North Carolina is also considered too close to call. Is there anything about these states that makes them more likely to be toss-ups?
Are you trying to get me to say something about race again?
Because I'm not trying to, but if you wish to, you're perfectly welcome.
I think that might be a factor, and it's not just race. I think that these are states where, maybe they're fundamentally conservative, not necessarily in the sense of being politically conservative, but conservative in the sense of change being perhaps not the thing that they are most fond of. These are states where people want to see some continuity, where a large amount of rural voters have seen their lives change and therefore maybe do want to vote for some kind of difference in office, and that's why it's so close, and that's why, you know, we're seeing such an amazing contest. But I think that there are concerns about what direction change will take them.
Well, race did not play a part in another really close race, the Senate race in Minnesota, which is going to an automatic recount. The margin is under 1,000 votes right now. If anybody ever asks,
amazing,
does my vote count, they have to look at this. Why do you think Norm Coleman was able to hold off Al Franken's challenge fairly successfully? There was talk not all that long ago that Franken was pulling ahead.
Yes, I think Franken ran a very ambitious campaign, if nothing else. But I also think that Minnesotans, they don't really care what the rest of the country thinks. Obviously, they've made some unorthodox choices in candidates before. But I think the idea of electing a comedian, I think some people maybe raised an eyebrow or two at that. But on the other hand, you did have this, you know, amazing wave election coming through. I mean, but also, Norm Coleman is not a fire-breathing, you know, rock-ribbed Republican. He's a fairly moderate kind of guy, and it's a fairly moderate kind of state. And I also think I have to tell you, I've spoken to some people in Democratic leadership, and there's some concern on the part of Democratic leadership. As much as they'd like to have as many people as possible, obviously, on their side in the Senate, that if Al Franken wins, it would set a not such a great precedent for the kind of candidates that the Democrats would bring in the future.
Joining us now from Florida is Adam C. Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. Barack Obama won Florida by 2.5%. Were there certain counties that determined that outcome?
You know, if you 67 counties in Florida, and if you look over the map, Obama just improved the Democratic margins almost everywhere. Particularly the I-4 corridor where I am is always a big battleground area. He did very well there. Miami-Dade, he racked up another more than 100,000 votes there. But it was really the Democrats have never had a significant ground campaign in Florida. Obama had offices and people in every, even the most hardcore Republican counties, and you can see it in the numbers. Even in the Panhandle, strong Republican areas, he did significantly better than Kerry did, and in many cases better than Gore did.
There was a gay marriage ban on the ballot that passed, and that was supposed to hurt Obama. How close was the vote on that?
In Florida, it's tough to get these things passed. It's a 60% threshold to pass them, and I think, ironically, Obama may have helped pass that. You know, he ramped up African-American turnout, and it's very likely that extra, you know, African-American turnout helped get that passed, because a lot of African-Americans absolutely supported that.
There was a lot of anxiety about Florida voting. How did things go yesterday? No hanging chads or anything like that?
No hanging chads, some scattered screw-ups here and there, but really, surprisingly, pretty well. No disasters.
And what was the atmosphere like when people were voting?
A lot of excitement. You know, we had almost 40% of the voters had already cast their votes prior, either by absentee mail-in ballot or at early voting locations. So, you know, it was a lot of nervousness. Nobody knew, you know, both sides knew this was going to be a squeaker. It always is. So Florida's always unpredictable. Obama won. You know, he's the first person since Jimmy Carter to get above 50% in Florida. But in many respects, the Republicans also did very well, given the anti-Republican wave. They held seats in the legislature. They only lost one congressional seat. It could have been a lot worse.
Well, they lost Congressman Tom Feeney's seat, but he had connections to Jack Abramoff, and that probably hurt him. One of the Democrats that lost a seat was Tim Mahoney, but then again, there was all that talk about all of his mistresses. I'm sure that hurt him.
Yeah, that was a disaster. The Democrats netted one. They also won another seat in the Orlando area, Rick Keller. But there was a lot of optimism that they might pick up a couple seats held by Cuban American Republicans in Miami, and those that didn't happen.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Adam C. Smith is political editor for the St. Petersburg Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and with us from Arizona, with the McCain campaign that she's been covering through much of the election, is Anna Marie Cox, the Time Magazine Swampland blog contributor. You've given up Wonkette and switched to Swampland for good?
As for the foreseeable future, but I think, like a lot of people today who've been covering the campaign or been working on campaign, I woke up this morning not only uncertain about whether or not the election had finally ended, but also uncertain about what I'll be doing next.
And you're uncertain about what you're doing next? What does that mean?
I've been covering the campaign for 2 years. The fact that there's not a campaign to cover leaves me feeling a little lost, quite frankly.
Have you spoken to people in the McCain campaign about how they see the future?
I have. I have spoken to people in the McCain campaign about their futures. I think that the short-term future involves a lot of sleep,
and perhaps some medication. And I mean that both in the, you know, recreational way, and also a lot of us have been fighting off various kinds of, you know, exhaustion-induced illnesses, and I think there's going to be a big run on vitamin C when everyone gets back to D.C.
We are going to look at California next. Joining me now for a look at how some of the initiatives on the California ballot turned out is Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
It's good morning in California. It's
good morning
already,
in California.
It's already the
well, it's
the
morning
afternoon.
For some people in California. Good morning for some people in California, not so good for others, I suppose.
What did you see yesterday as California voters headed to the polls? Was the turnout noticeably higher where you were?
The turnout was very high, and we're still waiting for the last votes to be counted, but it appears that it's going to set a record in numerical sense, although probably not a record in terms of percentage turnout. But it was definitely higher than it had been in recent elections, and it was a pretty strong Democratic year, but California voters tend to be a very an eclectic and fickle lot, so it was not quite the sweep that Democrats had hoped for, or that liberal groups had hoped for in ballot measures. It was the sort of mixed bag that usually comes out of California elections.
Well, Proposition 8, which would have amended the state constitution to ban gay marriage, seems headed for defeat, doesn't it?
Oh, no. It's passing.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yes. The latest vote, I just got them up on the screen right now. This is... It's got a 5-point lead. It appears to it's going to pass. This is what I mean by California. I mean, Barack Obama won by 2.5 million votes, and yet Proposition 8, which is a very conservative measure to ban same-sex marriage, is winning.
Now, there has always been concern that if an election is called before voting ends in California, then Californians won't feel the need to continue voting. Did that happen yesterday? Because it was called pretty early.
Frankly, we don't know yet. It's just too early to get that whole thing. We know that about 10 million votes were cast in the presidential election, which would indicate to me, and that there were still votes to be counted. We understand there's some late absentee votes as well as some precincts haven't fully counted their votes. So we're probably going to have a total of 10.5 or 11 million people vote. And that's pretty. It could be a little bit lower than the expectation was. About 13 million were going to vote. So we'll have to wait for the final tally to find out for sure. But I would say at least 11 million votes were counted, and that's pretty high for California.
Anna Marie, it seems like all of the gay rights initiatives have passed. The anti-gay rights initiatives have passed, which
has happened in Arizona similarly. Yes.
That's a values issue, which has usually helped Republicans. Anna Marie, do you think that we're kind of splitting these states? That's almost like a split ticket concept. Anna Marie, you there? Okay. Well, I don't know what happened to Anna Marie Cox, who was with us.
I'm here.
Oh yeah. Did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. Sorry.
So what do you think is going on here? Because I would have thought that most supporters of Barack Obama, liberals anyway, would have been more amenable to voting for same-sex marriage.
I actually have not seen the exit polls on this, so I don't feel like I have a real grasp on what happened, except to say that I think, quite honestly, I think there might be also just some simple confusion about what the vote was. I had conversations with people very recently, up until today almost, about asking me, so if I vote yes on that, is that yes for gay marriage? So maybe, I think this is reversible. Also, it is so close, so very close. And I think also it says something about the Republican Party that even Steve Schmidt, the campaign manager of the McCain campaign, actually himself supported voting against Proposition 8. I think that this is not a fight that's over. Even if Proposition 8 passes in this cycle, I think that you're going to see it come up again.
We thank you so much for talking with us, Dan. Dan Walters is the political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, and joining us now from the swing state of Colorado is Lynn Bartels, a political and legislative reporter for the Rocky Mountain News. We don't have a lot of time, Lynn, but what did you see as Coloradans headed to the polls as yesterday I guess, was there, how early did the polls open in Colorado?
We're a 7-7 state.
Mm-hmm. When we spoke in August at the Democratic National Convention, you said that independence would be a key to Colorado. Is that what happened yesterday?
Oh, absolutely. Although you have to give credit, the Democrat voter registration efforts in the state in the past year are amazing. 4 years ago, Republicans had 180,000 voter registration advantage. I believe that's down to about 11,000. But independents voted for change this year, and it didn't help many Republicans here. Democrats won the U.S. Senate seat.
Mark Udall beat Bob Schaffer.
Correct. And then they ousted Marilyn Musgrave in the 4th District.
So, was that a surprise? Because the Mark Udall victory was not.
No, and I don't think actually, when you look at what an incredible year it was for Democrats, there was no way that Maryland could have survived that.
So is Colorado now a blue state?
I will never say Colorado is a blue state. We are a pendulum state. We go back and forth. We'll have a couple of great election cycles for Republicans and then a couple of great election cycles for Democrats. Everybody, you know, everybody gets theirs in Colorado one day.
I was wondering, now that the election is over, an election that's gone on for nearly 2 years, what are all the political reporters going to do for a while?
Are you kidding? They already have us writing stories. Who's going to run against Governor Bill Ritter in 2010? You know, politics is not, it never ends. Now it's who's on the bench and who can do this and who can do that.
What's next for you, Anna Marie?
You know, again, I have to say I'm not entirely sure.
Uh-huh. Well, but there'll always be politics in Washington.
There will always be politics in Washington. And also, I have to say, this is going to be, we talked about whether or not this is a sea change for the party or a sea change for the country, and I'm not certain, but it is a sea change for Washington. And there's a whole new generation of people that will be coming into Washington who are very young, very energized, and who are going to remake sort of the social and political structure of Washington, D.C. That is a story that I'm going to be very excited to cover.
What about the lame duck aspects of the Bush administration? It looks like they're going to try to push an awful lot of stuff through that Barack Obama will have to then deal with.
Who is this Bush fellow you speak of? Or is there someone that I should be paying attention to named Bush? Yes, obviously, I think they're going to try to do a lot of things. But I also think that the people who want to hold on, the people that are going to be continuing their terms, the people in Congress who will be continuing their terms through the Obama administration, at least into the Obama administration, are not going to be so amenable to those changes that Bush wants to make. So I think that we're going to see a lot of attempts on the part of Bush to make some significant changes before he leaves, but I think that those attempts will not necessarily be greeted with success.
Well, you made a joke about President Bush disappearing, but I suspect there's going to be a resurgence for a little while, because there still is an agenda that perhaps it will be easier to promote now than there was when the election was going on, and it was unclear as where the country was going.
What do you think that agenda might include? I think that, you know, again, we were talking about I think one of the top things on his agenda personally and politically is the war on terror and the war in Iraq, and I think he has some breathing room on that. I think, you know, something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, that if I were a staffer in the Bush White House, if I were trying to make this president go out on a high note, I would actually alert people to the fact that they have had some successes in this administration, including among them and a dramatic increase in the success of homelessness programs, federal government homelessness programs. And I wonder if he might return to a little bit of the compassionate conservative storyline, just to go out on this election not looking as though it was he was clinging so bitterly at the end, as a candidate recently put it.
Have you been able to look at all of the statistics? Because it's, you know, they're all pretty fresh. For example, John McCain won married voters, but by just 51% to 47%. Hasn't there been a marriage gap in the past?
There has been a marriage gap in the past. I think in this particular case, I think married couples are, as much as anyone else, or married individuals, I should say, as much as anyone else, seeking something different, if not, you know, with each other, then at least in the government. I think this is an incredibly atypical election. I think it is far too soon for anyone to start making judgments about the future of the party, the future of electoral politics, the future of these various gender and marriage gaps that we have. The environment that these two candidates were going into is so negative against the Republicans. I think it would be far too soon to draw any permanent conclusions about what might happen going on.
Well, we mentioned earlier that the Palin strategy didn't work with women, although initially that it was thought that it might. There were some women who announced that after Hillary was defeated that they just couldn't go along with Barack Obama. But it is interesting that working women voted for Barack Obama 61% to 38%. I would think that most of those would have been the Hillary Clinton supporters.
I think so. And I have to say that from the beginning when there was speculation that the Hillary supporters would turn away from the Democratic Party based solely on the fact that Hillary didn't get the nomination, that never made sense to me. I think that women who lean Democrat are going to stay Democrats. They, while inspired by Hillary Clinton or affectionate about her candidacy, in the end, that party identification and the desire, again, for change and also the economic environment, they were definitely going to vote for Barack Obama.
Now, would you like to talk to some of our listeners?
I would love to talk to some of your listeners.
Okay. Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will be taking listener calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guest is Anna Marie Cox. I remember when we talked the first time, she was still the Wonkette. Now she's the Swampland blog contributor at Time Magazine. 212-433-9692. We'll be right back. We're back with Anna Marie Cox and your calls to 212-433-9692. And while we are working on those calls, Anna Marie, I know this is the cliche question, but did you have any favorite moments during the campaign?
I did. I have had many favorite moments during the campaign. Most of them probably do not reflect any particular political turning points, but rather the sort of personal narrative that's continued to be fascinating to me through this campaign. Performing karaoke in Nashville with some of the senior McCain staffers, I think will have to be something that I tell my children about. It was a moment where politics disappeared and we all just sort of threw ourselves into some classic country tunes for an evening.
Did the behavior of Bill Clinton surprise you at all? Because it took him a long time to come on board for Barack Obama, way after Hillary came on board.
That is true. And I also, I think that what happened with Bill Clinton is we have to rewrite the history book on Bill when it comes to his so-called political genius. He's a political genius for himself. When he's campaigning for himself, when he's doing his own speeches, when he's promoting himself, he is, in fact, one of the most natural politicians America has ever seen. You know, conscripted into serving the causes of others, including his wife, I'm not sure if he made the best decisions possible.
Let's take some calls. We start with Michael from Brooklyn. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Michael.
Hi. I wanted to comment on something that she had said. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Anne Marie, am I correct?
Anna Marie. Anna Marie Cox.
Okay. I apologize for having forgotten that. You had asked her about Proposition 8, why you thought there was such a discrepancy between, in California, a state that voted heavily for Obama, but at the same time seems to have voted fairly heavily for a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, and you thought there was some inconsistency there. And she had kind of speculated that perhaps it was due to some confusion regarding what voting yes meant and what voting no meant. Which really isn't much of an answer because presumably there would be equal confusion for people on either side of the issue, so it should kind of balance out.
By the way, it's just been called and the ban has passed.
I'm sorry?
It's just been called by the Associated Press. The ban has been passed in California.
Yeah, it's no surprise. I mean, it was basically, I was kind of paying attention overnight, and it was up almost the entire time by a couple of percentage points. It never went less than, I think, being up by 4%.
So, Michael, you're saying the point is that the margin of error is equal on both sides.
Yeah, so I don't think that that had anything to do with it, but I think that she's, you know, missing a very obvious point, which is that the black community obviously voted in favor of Obama something approaching 100%, whereas most people in the black community are very against the idea of gay marriage. Most people are fairly religious. There's a lot of churchgoers in the black community. And so I think many of those people that turned out specifically to vote for Obama at the same time voted for Proposition 8, and not because they misunderstood what they were voting for, mm-hmm. but because that's what they actually feel.
And I think to some degree that's what you said, Anna Marie, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And also I would point out, in addition to African-Americans being perhaps progressive in a lot of political ways but socially conservative, I would add Hispanic-Americans are the same way. Or historically, polls have shown that while maybe voting Democratic would not necessarily be in favor of voting against Proposition 8. So that indeed, I credit the caller for putting a little more point to my somewhat vague answer.
There. But let me pursue this a bit further. Some years back, there were people in the Republican Party who pointed out that that there were many people in the black community who agreed on the big values issues that the Republican Party had subscribed to, and they felt that they should go after those black voters, and then they decided not to. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'm not sure they decided not to. I actually think that people like Karl Rove and Grover Norquist attempted with great enthusiasm to pursue those ethnic groups, including not just African-Americans, but also, I said, Hispanic-Americans, and also Grover Norquist pursued Muslim Americans as potential voting bloc for Republicans. In the end, that never bore fruit, and I think it has to do with sort of a general feeling in the leadership of the Republican Party that it wouldn't work out. I don't think it was ever pursued in the kind of full-throated way that might have made a difference.
Jan from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I heard something about that he really wanted John Edwards as vice president. But under the circumstances, and do you hear of anything where he could be in this administration, maybe attorney general or something?
What, that Barack Obama wanted John Edwards?
Yeah.
Which became impossible after the John Edwards scandal. Anna Marie, do you think that John Edwards is washed up for a while in the same way that Elliot Spitzer is?
I have to say, I think it's not necessarily a good thing, but yes, and in fact, that is. We haven't reached a point in American politics where you can come right back from a scandal like that, no matter what his truly genuine qualifications might be for attorney general or for some other cabinet position. He's going to have to lay low for a bit.
We go next to Jim from Queens. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I wanted to say that I think that Sarah Palin lost the election, and that had he picked even Joe Lieberman, he would have been elected. People I know, I'm in my 50s. I've always admired John McCain, but I'm a lifelong Democrat. People I know who would have voted for McCain absolutely were insulted by the choice and thought they were underestimated and felt like McCain was a dangerous guy for doing it.
You want to respond to that?
Is there a question there, sir?
Well, I feel like we're slicing and dicing a lot of issues, and I think the obvious one is the vice presidential choice blew up the campaign.
Well, I think that definitely it turned out that way. I won't back away from an answer originally on this, which is that Sarah Palin could have worked out, but the fact that she was a candidate that needed so much work done, that needed so much support, made her ultimately, yes, a total drag on the ticket, if only because they didn't have the resources to really babysit her in the way that she turned out to need.
We thank you for your call. Somebody else mentioned the possibility of of Edwards having been Obama's vice presidential choice. Well, we know that Joe Lieberman was McCain's vice presidential choice. And I wonder if you were following the dynamic between McCain, Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham, the Three Musketeers.
Yes.
And then we could throw in perhaps Phil Graham as well, or is Phil Graham totally gone by now?
Phil Graham is not one of the Three Musketeers, I can tell you that. Phil Graham, while I think very much respected by John McCain, very much, you know, a part of a circle of advisors that he listens to, was not someone that was really weighing in heavily on the vice presidential choice. I think that Lindsey definitely saw a Lieberman pick as being transformational. Lindsey really wanted to make this about being different than the rest of the history of the Republican Party, being about politics, as a matter of fact, and also to make a statement saying that John McCain cares about the country more than he cares about any particular party. And personally, I am not someone that would find a Lieberman choice something that would compel me, but I do think the narrative of putting everything above party would have been something that could have worked, although who knows? It might not have been as close as it is because he might have lost all those base voters that did turn out in part to vote for Sarah Palin.
Now, Joe Lieberman has been caucusing with the Democrats even though he is an independent. Do you think that's possible now after what has happened during this campaign?
It's possible. I mean, the Senate is actually politicians are generally, no matter what they say in the Senate, pretty pragmatic. And I think that McCain and Lieberman's Senate colleagues will realize that they all need each other to get things done. And I think, actually, Lieberman in some ways has a freer road ahead of him, more choices, more options available to him than some Democrats, some you know, technical Democrats.
Now, you mentioned during the campaign, many people on the right accused Obama of being a socialist, practically a communist, but you talked about his centrist tendencies. You think he will govern as a centrist?
I do. I do think so.
Do you think that liberals and progressives are going to be disappointed with an Obama presidency?
Well, I'll tell you what. I hope they're disappointed in the sense that I hope that there is pushback from the left against Obama moving to the center. I worry that his amazing charisma, his amazing sort of inspirational qualities and the historic nature of his candidacy will not mute, but at least, you know, tone down some of the criticisms he might get from progressives. I think progressives need to be the first people out of the gate to call Obama on some of the things that he'd done to move to the center, the FISA legislation, among other things.
We have time to sneak in one more call. Alan from Queens, hi, you're on the air. Can you make it quick?
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Anna Marie, about some of these tensions that developed towards the end of the campaign between Governor Palin and the McCain campaign. Some unsourced aides spoke to Politico, to Washington Post. Do you think that had a real effect towards the end of the campaign, and did you witness any of that yourself? Thank you.
I'm sorry, my cell is fading just a little bit. What was the end of that question?
He wondered if you had witnessed any of that tension that was reported in places like Politico.com.
Yes. I think the McCain campaign takes a lot of its identity from the idea of loyalty. And I think that to the extent that there were people on the McCain campaign that were disappointed in the performance of Governor Palin, it probably had to do with the fact that they were not convinced that she had the senator's best interests at heart, first in line all the time.
But weren't they really undermining the possibility of a win by leaking all of that embarrassing stuff?
And this is where I will say that they value loyalty perhaps above discipline, because I would say in the Obama campaign, no matter what would have happened, no matter what personal grievances or personal ambitions might have been at play, no one would have said anything. I think that this is a case where the deep loyalty that many staffers felt to McCain trumped their notions about what might help them actually win, if that makes sense. This has been a bizarre sort of dynamic. But,
well, it's odd because Republicans have always been called the party that
were more
disciplined. And in this case, we've seen the most disciplined campaign in the history of America from the Democrats, the party of disarray, who knows what that means for the future. It's frightening me just a little bit.
Well, it's
a brave new world.
It's a brave new world, and also it's a world where the Republican Party is going to have to remake itself. You were asking me if this means anything new for the Democratic Party. I think the party that's really facing a lot of tough decisions in a whole new, you know, kind of way to identify itself is the Republican Party, because John McCain, whatever he was, he's never been a standard bearer for the Republican Party, and he was not the person that was ever going to lead this party as a movement.
Anna Marie Cox, we have to leave it there. Anna Marie Cox, Time Magazine, Swampland blog contributor. Thank you so much for being with us today.
All right, thank you.